The 12th of October is rather a significant date, as you'll find out as I go through three or four dates. The first one was in 1861, the first Cobb & Co. coach reached Lawrence from Dunedin, and it cut the time, was 2 days, but it cut it down to 9 hours. Now, this is because they brought over their own horses and a new coach from Australia, and that was the first Cobb & Co. got going. In 1866, the Howes were defeated at Omaranui and at Estale in Hawke's Bay. So this morning, celebrations went on out there. The defeated tribes wanted the local tribes to forgive them. So I happened to go out there, which was a very boring thing, but it took an hour and a half, all in Maori, and the only names that I really recognised was McLean plus Whitmore, and all the rest was in Maori. But anyhow, there was 100 on one side and about 40 on the other, in two separate tents. In 1864, on the 12th, the first train to Hastings and the official opening of the Hastings to Napier railway track. In 75, that's a year later, was the passing and the abolition of the Provinces Act. So therefore, by the Legislative Council, which had a fair bit of bearing, but we won't go into that today. In 1917 was New Zealand's saddest day in history, because we lost 45 officers and 500 soldiers, all lost their lives at Passchendaele on our worst ever day as far as the war was concerned. On the 18th, the Niagara arrived at Auckland with 25 serious cases of Spanish influenza. They said that they'd radioed in and told them that they had them, and they were told that they were allowed to proceed into Auckland. And they did sort of radio in the week before when they got up to the top of the North Island, but they let them proceed. So that's how our epidemic started, because the fact is that they let the Niagara in. So I'm going to talk about now the railway. Now, I've got some photos up there on the railway. I'd like to project them, because every picture tells its own story. The construction of the Napier-Manawatū Railway was part of Vogel's policy of public works and assisted immigration to lift the country out of economic doldrums and to open up the stronghold of Maori resistance at the centre of the North Island to the lanes of white settlement. It was welcomed in Napier as a means of promoting agricultural settlement on the plains, developing a local timber trade and a special settlements in bush districts. The provincial government had three alternative routes surveyed, and the battle of routes across Hiratonga Plains commenced. The government's choice of the beach route from Napier to Farnham, then straight across the centre of the Hiratonga Plains to Patipata, was based on the opinions of competent surveyors and engineers. The Napier surveyor, James Rochford, provincial engineer and surveyor in charge of the railway, Charles Webber, and the chief engineer of the Public Works Department, James Carruthers, it was a primary matter of cost and anticipated effects of flooding. The final stages that changed the course of the Narrabora River was an important consideration. Webber's preliminary report on the 17th of October 1870, I'll only mention the last date as far as what I'm talking about is in the 18th century. A fuller report on the 7th of October 71 based the surveys definitely in favour of the beach route rather than the inland route from Napier to the Karamu Junction, a national point on the map in the centre of the Hiratonga Plains where alternative routes met, south from Karamu Junction to Takapau. Webber, in his 71 report, referred to Air Te Ati, Waipawa, Waipakarau. The alternative routes were based via Foster's Gorge and Middle Road, south from Havanau, north to Potongata, or Air Marakotahu to Guavas. On the grounds of cost of loan, the latter was out of the question. Although the Te Ati route was estimated to cost more than the Middle Road route, it had an advantage of being more central. It was more open to new country and provided rail access to the Te Ati bush for timber and firewood, and consequently larger revenue from freight. From an engineering point of view, John Carruthers and Bell, Bowden's and Sons' second engineer, referred to the beach route from the port to Pukeput. In Carruthers' opinion, it was a cheap line. Bridges would be required over the Iron Pot, the Waitangi Creek, and three crossings of the Ngarrarua. The only expensive work would be the first mile skirting Cinder Island. So remember that, we're going from the Spit to Pukeput. Where the Ngarrarua should be bridged was a matter which had to be decided in the light of the change of the course after the 1867 flood. Weber proposed two bridges across overflow creeks, the Tutaikuri in the Waitemat, and one station near the Ngarrarua River Bridge to accommodate the districts of Clive, Waitangi and Pākehā. A second at the centre of the Heratonga Flats and a third at Pukeput. It was become clear that the bridging of the overflow creeks would be formidable because the main flow had permanently established itself in a new channel. Weber surveyed another line south of Clive and crossed a full stream and abandoned the bed below Pākehā, which was now the old bed near Pukeput. Possible alternative was a single crossing of the new main channel at Pākehā, but Crevis considered it too expensive and not safe. Leading district actively supported the route that best served their land interest. The strongest and most vocal group represented a very considerable population, both European and Maori, from Port Hariri to Omahu and then up the Tutaikuri Valley and Whairangi. In 72, they held a meeting and appointed the deputation to wait on the Ministry of Works. Included W.R. Russell, member of the Provincial Council, and his brother, the Provincial Superintendent, J.D. Ormond, who owned Karamu, said not to be quite disinterested as he made out. These settlers wanted the direct line from the Spit through Miani, Karadal, Green Meadows to Omahu, bridging the Tutaikuri at Redcliffe and the Ngarrarua at Pākehā, with stations at Waiheke, Pākehā or Norris's Corner. The government rejection of this route gave lie to later allegations of string pulling and political influence. It was too far in for the settlers of Clive, Munga Territory and Havelock North. The Havelock North settlers considered they were entitled to more attention than a station at Morris's Corner. In his report to Ormond in May 72, Carruthers favoured the beach route through the Karamu Junction and Pukeput. In 10th of August 72, a tender for construction was led to the British firm of John Ogden and Sons. 26th of August was a public holiday in Napier to celebrate the turning of the first sod. Tenders for the building for a fourth class railway station at Hastings were not called until February 74. However, the site was known at least 2 years before this. 6 months before the line was supposed to open, the Havelock North settlers turned their attention to forming a feeder road to it. A meeting of settlers was called to consider the question and favoured the building of a bridge at the end of the road which went down to the old riverbed of the Ngarrarua and by Tommy Reynolds' Havelock Hotel. Moreover, they were prepared to defray a considerable proportion of the cost. Tanner, who was a member of the Heratonga board, actively supported the group. Talk among the leading settlers in the district forming a company and building a branch railway came to naught. In talking about the beginnings of Hastings, early settlers have created legends that are often regarded as history. The local people firmly believe that Francis Hicks, who bought a 100-acre block from Thomas Tanner, was the founder father of Hastings, and that the township was originally named Hicksfield. Hicks, so they say, gave the government an acre and a half for the railway station on the condition that the railway line ran through Hastings, not Havelock North. These are myths and misinterpretation of the history of early Hastings. Before Hicks laid off the sections in Hastings, the township had sprung up at Karamu, and the government decided to route the Napier Pukeput section of railway from Farndon to a national Karamu junction in the centre of the plains. The Karamu store and post office and the proposed railway station were on Hicks's block of land, which became the business centre of Hastings. Within weeks of the sale of Hicks' land, he sold his land on the 8th of July, 73, and he got a good price for it, I might add. Someone else had a block alongside him, James Boyle, laid off sections, and the subsequent land sales extended Hastings outwards from two central 100-acre blocks cutting up by Hicks and Boyle. So then it went on after to subdivide Riversleigh, but that's why the railway runs through the centre of Hastings. The most dramatic advance in Napier development in 74 was the opening of the Southern Railway. Before the plate laying began, 10,000 timber sleepers were floated down the Tukituk River. They were made up into large rafts at the river mouth near Clive and towed by a steamer to the harbour at Pandora Point, that's on the outside of the Bluff Hill. There were small boats then took them in tow along a deep tidal channel to the foot of Sund Island to head the railway. The rails for the first 10-mile section from the Spit to Pukipuk were landed in April 72 from the barge Shannamon. The contract to lay these rails was let, and it was just under £50,000. In 72, a start had already made for the line between Napier and the port. It was not only to provide relief work for the unemployment, but to keep them on hand for the main work. The Puki Mokomoko Hill, near the junction of Carlisle Street and Chaucer Road. There's a diamond of land there that comes down to George's Drive, and where Hyderabad Road turns round, there's a diamond of land from where the army is now, right down to the corner. That was a hill, and there's a picture of that hill on the board. So was removed to make way for the railway, and the spoil was used to reclaim Owen Street and Thackeray Street. A footbridge two planks wide with no handrail was spanned a tidal channel connect Wellesley Road with the mainland at the corner of Thackeray and Miller Streets. Now you've got to remember that if you have a look at these pictures after, picture tells a thousand stories, you'll find the railway stations in the middle of a lake. So there we are. £1,000 was set aside for reclaiming land for wharfage to accommodate port on Gough Island. So Gough Island is marked on one of those maps. This work was carried out and was completed by 74, and it's claimed that the area was the best wharfage and harbour frontage in the whole harbour. From Napier to Farndon, the railway cut off from the rest of the swamp a triangle of land between the railway line and Hastings Street. So you can imagine the railway line now at Hastings Street, and there's a diamond of land being free from tidal scour because they put in an embankment there. The land dried out and rapidly became possible to reclaim the area now Voltaire, Russell, Monroe and Station Streets. So they were all semi-swamped, those areas. And this is something that's perhaps a little bit of local interest. Of course, they decided that the railway wasn't going to go through Tarragon. So on the other side of the swamp, a causeway to carry the road to Tarragon was being built. This is at the same time as the hill was being taken down. So no matter where you are in Napier, you want spoil. They still can't spoil to fill in. So they took the hill, they blasted the Bluff Hill down, and they ran barges out into the inner harbour and picked up spoil from any island that was sort of not wanted, and with a barge they could put it back into the town. So the causeway to carry the Tarradale Road had gaps to allow the sea to flow into the lagoon and gaps for a bridge, and despite of the gaps, the causeway blocked and ready flow of the tide into chains of lagoons and silting up and drying process started. The first locomotives were unloaded from a paddle steamer, the Patterson. Now this paddle steamer belonged to the contractors. I think they might have weighed 15 tonne, and they used it with service to ballast the line during the construction. In June 74, the line had reached Waikangi, 5 miles south of Napier. A month later, Brogdon and Sons invited members of the Provincial Council, together with their family and friends, to a picnic. as carriages had not arrived in time for the celebrations, 150 guests climbed into a line of open trucks drawn up in Napier. They sat on wooden benches, thoughtfully covered with white calico, while the engine rattled the trucks along at 20 miles an hour. After a ride of 14 minutes, they reached Waitini, where they stopped for dinner, had speeches, numerous toasts, and champagne before returning to Napier. When the line reached Hastings, the people expected a public celebration to honour the beginning of the rail services. Their hopes were dashed when Mr. J.D. Orman, the superintendent of the province, shifted to Brogdon's Fair to complete the line to Puckypuck on the contract time. He therefore refused to authorise any expenditure of public funds and to celebrate a contract. If the contract had won such a function, they'd have to pay for it themselves. There were no bands and champagne dinners when the first train left Napier on October the 12th, 1974, and only a few passengers on board. They paid 3 shillings for the return fare and enjoyed Bondon's celebration dinner in Hastings. That's the Napier story. So here we come. About 10:40 on Monday, the 12th of October, the first train from Napier steamed into the partly constructed Hastings Railway Station, its engine bedecked with flags, ferns and greenery. Over 100 people, including most of Napier's leading citizens and a fair sprinkling of womenfolk, the town band crammed into 2 passenger carriages displaying bunting on their roofs and overflowed into 2 trucks and a brake van. The 12-mile journey took 36 minutes, with 2-minute stop at Farnborough and a brief stop at Mr. Williams. The first 4 miles followed the beach, as we know, and then crossed the Waitangi Bridge over the tidal stream and veered south over the Heratonga Plain studded with grazing sheep. Despite the disagreeable northwester, which stirred up dust, the passengers contrast the ease and pleasantness of visiting Hastings by train with the ogres of a coach trip over a rough road, Ayr Havelock North. So if you want to go to Hastings, you had to go Ayr Havelock North before. As the wind was too much for the canvas tent erected for the champagne luncheon by the proprietor of the railway hotel, William Goodwin, the visitors crowded into his dining room. Joseph Rose, a member of the Hawke's Bay Provincial Council, proposed the health of John Henderson, who represented Brogdon and Sons, the railway contractors, and the toast was drunk with the musical honours. While dining, room was being cleared for dancing, a christening ceremony was held at the station platform. Miss Clayton broke a bottle of champagne over the engine, naming it Miss Hastings. Many gentlemen took the opportunity to visit the cattle yards, which had been got ready for the forthcoming agricultural and pastoral show. Fair ladies and their partners danced with much spirit to the band. Meanwhile, the gale kept increasing in violence. Indeed, a sudden gust blew the roof of the station, shattering sheets of corrugated iron far and wide. Fortunately, no one was hit. Towards 4 p.m, rather earlier than first contemplated, there was a general move to the platform for the return trip. On the way home, the train obligingly stopped several times to put down passengers and to allow those travelling in cattle trucks to chase their hats. Telegraphic communications were interrupted as the line was down in several places, but fortunately the rain held off until late in the evening. The opening of the railway allowed only for a short distance after a very long delay, we think will have been an event which a town in the province could be congratulated, Hawke's Bay Herald reported. And we hope before the end of the year to see the line working order from the Spit to Puckypuck. I've kept on calling it Caramu, so here we go. Robert Somerville took over the Caramu postmaster in January 1974 for a salary of £5 from H. Williamson, who seems to have succeeded Tobias Hicks. The name of the post office was changed to Hastings on the 24th of September 1975, and Hastings postmark was brought to use. Money facilities were added in October 75, and the post office moved into the railway station, and the station master, David A. Wright, became postmaster at $125 a year on the 1st of December 75, and was also the local calligraphist. Hastings had a mail order service once started from Napier Central Post Office. A fourth class railway station was plain wooden square building, no veranda, and the platform was made of rough swimming timber, planks under which boys used to clamber. The 125 pound goods yard was constructed by Edward Ashton in 1875. From 21st of October 1874, George Grant had livery stables in Havelock North, and he ran a coach service by road to Napier and commenced a Havelock to Hastings service to connect with the arrival and departure of the train three times daily each way. He also hired buggies and saddle horses. The Napier Havelock North coach was restored in October 74. At first, the railway attracted curiosity, but passenger revenue soon declined. The night service from Hastings to Napier was cancelled on a complaint of only one passenger one night, being Captain William Russell of Flaxmere. But the new service did become a popular freight hauler. Ordinary merchandise was carried at 3 shillings a tonne, while firewood, grain, iron and other materials went at a reduced rate of 2 shillings per tonne, with an additional handling charge of 3 shillings for receipt and delivery. Timber was conveyed at 11 pence per 100 foot, apparently an inexpensive rate, but wool was charged at a much higher rate, namely at 1 shilling and 7 pence per bale, because wool growers were rich and could afford to pay for the accommodation. Nevertheless, the rate was much cheaper than road carriage charges. In November 1874, the bridge had been built from the head of the Iron Pot on the Spit to the reclaimed land around Gough Island, providing a rail link between the port and Napier. The branch line, backed by the promise of a station, scheduled 5 trains daily. And this was opened on the 26th of November. Apart from the delay caused by one engine got off the line, while a horse throwing its rider on Hyderabad Road was the first day's mishap. Passenger train services ran to the port till 1908. Napier had some facilities, had a good shed, 60 foot by 30 foot, and they also had a crane, engine shed and a turntable. At the same time, the Spit had a third car station building and passenger platform and a cart road and a 220 foot by 30 foot goods shed, loading bank, cattle yards, weigh bridge and a turntable. When the 12 mile section, what is known as the Napier Puckypuck Railway, opened, there were only 2 short lengths of public railway in operation in the North Island, apart from the wooden horse-drawn Palmerston North Foxton Tramway. These were Auckland Onehunga and Wellington Mahutton lines, each 8 miles in length. Before the opening of the Hastings line, the local railway route mileage open from New Zealand was 155 miles. It was figured ultimately to reach 3,600. The Littleton Tunnel had been built by that time. The Daily Mail reported, this is sometime after Mr. Thatcherwald's father, George, was one of the original employees that instructed the line from Napier. Before coming to New Zealand, Mr. Thatcherwald Sr. was a plate layer employed by the Great Western Railway Company in England. When he came to Hawke's Bay and volunteered to work on the construction of the new line, he was quickly engaged when it was learned that he was an experienced plate layer. Whereas he had earned 24 shillings a week in England, he was paid at the rate of 9 shillings a day in New Zealand, a wage which in those days was exceptionally high. Padded seats and carriages were undreamed of luxury, and there were no partitions in cars. All trains comprised of goods and passenger vehicles. High speeds were never encouraged. The best a train travelled as little more than 25 miles an hour. Time bells in those days were not closely adhered to as today. This book, I'm afraid, was written 30 years ago. On occasions, trains would wait a few minutes to suit the convenience of passengers. The Thatcherall family lived close to the railway line, about a mile from Puckypuck. Mrs. Thatcherall, when she wished to go to Napier for the day, would place a chair alongside the railway line. An accommodating driver would note the signal and off the train and wait the passenger. They were certainly keen on business those days. The rolling stock consisted in 75 of a 12-ton engine. I told you it was 15, but it was 12. A locomotive D. It's much the same as the one on the picture up there, but it was at Timona, and Timona kept things for a long time, so it was the same sort of engine. One six-wheel carriage and three second-class six-wheel carriages, four brake vans, three covered wagons, six high-sided wagons, 12 low-sided wagons and five timber wagons. Meanwhile, the railway construction continued the railway southward from Hastings, and 1st of January 75, the Hastings Puckypuck section was opened. The following year, it was opened to Opapa, which was then Te Ati, and in February, it was opened to Waipawa and Waipapa Rau. The completion of the Waipapa Rau railway bridge, which is celebrated on the 1st of September 76, a very enthusiastic crowd estimated by the Herald corresponded to be 800, described as the cream of cream. Triumphant floral arches were erected on the bridge and the station. Miss Herbert, a sister-in-law of H.R. Russell, a prominent farmer, broke a bottle of champagne and christened the engine Diverna. A large elm, which until recently stood at the back of the station, was planted to commemorate the occasion. Headed by the Napier Band, the crowd proceeded to the Tavistock Hotel, nearly half a mile distance, where luncheon continued all afternoon, notwithstanding on the care of the railway authorities. When the train left for Napier, quite a few people, full of joy and beer, were left behind. At least the passengers remembered the event long after most of the sober passengers had forgotten it. 12th of March 77, trains were running to Takapau, and in 78 the line was opened to Kaupua, 62 miles south of Napier. To celebrate the event, a general holiday was declared in Napier, and a well-patronised passenger train with 22 carriages ran to Kaupua. Kaupua hasn't got anything now. That's where the seminary is, down that road towards the corner. But there's nothing left at Kaupua. It might have had a population. And I think it had two hotels, one or two other things. Great disappointment to the people of Norswood. The line bypassed their village and then went straight through the bush from Takapau to Dannevirke, which was reached in 1884. Even Dannevirke, a large centre, almost missed having the railway station in the centre of the town. The railway construction near Dannevirke, a strip of bush one train wide, was felled along the top of the terrace east side of the Mangatira stream with a view of crossing the stream near the present racecourse. I don't even know if they've got a racecourse now, and then having a railway station further down the road, thus missing Dannevirke by about a mile. Fortunately, better counsel prevailed, although the felled line is still plainly seen through the bush. The line reached Woodville in 87. On the day that the line opened to Woodville, on 22nd of March, hundreds of people, a queue 10 deep, crowded Napier booking office window to purchase tickets for a special train which ran to the new railhead 95 miles away. Three large steam locomotives headed a special train consisting of 19 carriages and two vans, and according to a contemporary report, totaled, well, I've got two figures on this. One says 1,200 and the other says 15, so we'll take it from there. The work on the line through the Manawatu Gorge began in 88, but it was not connected with Palmer's until March 91. By 91, when Woodville and Palmer's North was finally linked by rail through the Manawatu Gorge, the major North Island government railway ran a roughly formed letter U from Napier to New Plymouth, and was officially known is the Napier-Taranaki section of the New Zealand Railway. From this branch, the Foxton Line, then government-owned and rebuilt with iron rails and served by locomotives, and a short length of main trunk line ended a few miles north of Hunterville. From Longburn, the privately owned Wellington and Manawatu Railway Company, line runs south to Wellington. Opened in 68 and taken over by the government in 1908, the line provided the only rail link between Hawke's Bay and the capital until the completion in December 97 of the Wellington Woodville Line through the Wairarapa District. The first timetable of services dated 91, number 9, express from Napier, due out at 11:45, connected at Palmerston with the mail train from New Plymouth, which was timed to leave Palmerston North at 10:05, and arrived at Longbourn, 4 miles south, at 5:05. There was a connection made to Wellington and the Manawatu Railway Company, and it reached Wellington at 10 minutes to 10. The total time from Napier to Wellington, 11 hours, 5 minutes. Much the same on the reverse. They had a change at Longbourn, so we won't go into that. With the completion of the line through the Wairarapa in 97, the through Napier-Wellington trains were rerouted air Woodville and Marston over the Fell-operated Rimutaka incline to Upper Hutt and then on to Wellington. The express trains actually took the total journey time when they went through the Wairarapa 12 hours, 23 minutes. After the purchase of the Wellington and Manawatu Railway Company by the government, the through express was again routed through Manawatu. Rail cars started running to Wellington, to Napier and Wairoa when the Wairoa line was opened in 39. A standard rail car used to run from Wellington to Wairoa on Saturdays and return Sundays, and completed the Napier to Wellington sector in 5 hours 12 minutes. So that's a slight difference. The early operation of the Hawke's Bay Railway was without its moments of grant. In 79, a year after the Takapiratopu section had been opened, a New Zealand version of a great train holder. The incident featured not galloping horses and six-shooters, but a sleeping barricade, a fence across the track, and an angry Maori chief with a tomahawk. Also, the commodity sought by culprits was not gold, but a man's life. It all began when a rather tactless guard laid hands on Chief Tarawa and ran him out of the carriage platform after the chief refused to stop smoking his pipe in a non-smoking carriage. Later, the angry chief laid a pile of sleepers across the track and a wire fence was erected. The land over which the railway ran belonged to the tribe, and the loan negotiations had been made for its purchase to the government. No payment had been made, and he was exercising his rights as an owner. Tarawa announced he had no intention of preventing trains going through. All he wanted to do was hold the train up long enough to drag out the guard who insulted them and tomahawked them. By the time the planned hold reached the local authorities, the train was already on its way. A message was clearly tapped over the railway telegraph in an intermediate station warning the guard to keep him out of the danger area until the trouble had blown over. There was another incident of the recession with permanent results recorded to Mona at Hastings in 1881. A new flag station was opened and it was to be named Karamu, if you please, after the other. Karamu was the name of a shrub, by the way. The name which the local natives took exception. For a few days after the opening, the offending station board remained in place and then it was removed by the complainants, who replaced it with another board bearing the name Tamona. Tamona remains today. When the railway was wrecked in 31, the link by train was re-established on February the 6th. I always tell the story that the Pukipa freezing works was full of meat, frozen carcasses, and therefore they were still frozen and was loaded on a train and taken south.